Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here with news on sales tax revenues. They've improved, though they're still down year over year. The Delaware Youth Center's annual River Race is back this weekend. We'll talk with race director Edward Vandershans about how the region's biggest road, one of the region's biggest road races, helps fund the youth programs and why it's become a summertime tradition in Calicoon. Plus, music has always played a role in movements for change. We'll preview Music to the People, an evening of protest songs at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance tomorrow. And what can an old family photograph reveal? We'll talk with a photo detective about uncovering the hidden stories in historic photographs. Coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Wildfire smoke from Canada is seeping into large parts of the United States, pushing air quality to unhealthy levels from the Dakotas to the Midwest and East Coast. NPR's Kristen Wright reports pollution has reached dangerous levels in some areas, with the Washington Monument sitting behind a haze of smoke.
The air quality is expected to get worse throughout the day in D.C., where you can smell the smoke at times. Detroit, Chicago, and New York are experiencing some of the worst air quality in the world, according to rankings by IQ Air. And meteorologists say it's among the worst in years. Parts of Pennsylvania hit code purple, which is worse than red. Smoke from more than 800 wildfires burning in Canada is able to travel long distances, and the summer heat can make the air quality even worse. Officials are advising people to stay indoors, especially older adults, children, and those with health issues. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump and his team have been teasing what they called a bombshell announcement on election integrity this week. But as NPR's Miles Parks reports, Trump's speech to the nation last night provided no new evidence for the fraud claims the president has been making for years.
Last night's unveiling of newly declassified material tracked with what was already known about the 2020 election. Take Trump's claims about China, for instance. He described a sinister plot to interfere in the 2020 election, involving access to millions of voter records. But it was known China favored Joe Biden as a candidate, and the data Trump is talking about is generally public record and widely available, says David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research.
Having the voter data itself doesn't allow you to change anything. I can have my kids' class list, but that doesn't mean I can change the grades of everybody in the class.
Trump provided no new evidence for any fraudulent votes cast in American elections. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
People in Venezuela continue digging out from last month's pair of powerful earthquakes that left widespread destruction and more than 4,800 people dead. As John Otis reports, the quakes have put the country's return to democracy on hold, and that's sparking protests.
These protesters in Caracas are calling on Venezuela's authoritarian regime to hold free elections. But President Delcy Rodriguez is ignoring their demands to focus on earthquake recovery. Her government has also blocked opposition leader Maria Corina Machado from returning to Venezuela. Before holding new elections, experts say that Venezuela must first reform its pro-regime electoral council and judicial system. Another challenge is reviving political parties. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Caracas.
This is NPR News in Washington. Federal health officials have linked a major cyclospora outbreak to shredded iceberg lettuce served at Taco Bell in five states. More than 1,600 cases have been reported in Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and West Virginia. The FDA traced the lettuce from Mexico to a single supplier, which has not been publicly identified. Taco Bell says it stopped using the lettuce from that supplier as the investigation continues. More rain is expected in Texas, where days of downpours have triggered widespread flooding. At least two people have died, and more than 200 others have been rescued. The Homeland Security Department is changing its rules for foreign students. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports the department is adding fixed limits to how long international students can stay in the U.S.
Historically, international students could remain in the States as long as they were making progress in their academic program. Under the new rule, most foreign students will be admitted to the U.S. for a fixed period of time, up to 4 years. If they need more time to finish, which many students do, they will now have to apply for a formal extension. Fanta Ah, the executive director and CEO of NAFSA, the Association of International Educators, called the move misguided and unnecessary, a solution in search of a problem. Universities worry this could impact programs with variable durations, such as graduate programs, medical schools, and PhDs. Already, international student enrollment for graduate programs is down compared with last year. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And joining us on a Friday, Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yes, I'm happy to be here, at least to be able to see you through less of a smoky haze than yesterday.
Yeah, it has pushed south. The National Weather Service is saying it's going to be a little bit better in the New York area. However, all of Pennsylvania is under a purple air quality alert. That is the very unhealthy highest level there, I think. So anyone with any pre-existing conditions should be inside. Even if not, you might want to just stay inside. It is not good for folks with lung or heart conditions. Just be cautious when you're outdoors. And it's been a couple of, tough days for folks.
Yeah. Somebody said to me, I didn't know Canada stunk so much.
Oh, now you, please.
No, it's listen, I was listening actually to the program this morning just before we were on, and it explained it very well that as I've said to people too, I think this is part of a natural cycle of wildfires, but it's getting worse and it's moving east, and firefighters are not necessarily going to attack it in just open forest where there's no human habitation, because in many places this is how the forest recycles itself. But I am also one of those folks who grew up in this area and never remember it having this level of smoke before. So things definitely are changing, and we have to be cautious about it. I don't know what we can do about it here, but
well, it's important to remember Canada has like one of the largest coverage of forest in the world, and so naturally there are going to be wildfires there. And then this particular one, my understanding is that it's a combination of the wildfires in very remote areas that can't be accessed or managed, and that's combined with some of the weather patterns that's kind of keeping this trapped and pushed into our area. So, yeah, not a lot you can do except for take precaution at the county level. What's the reaction there? In terms of
our public health team has put out caution about it, basically the same thing that you're hearing elsewhere, just letting people know that, well, yesterday and the day before, the air quality levels were unhealthy for everybody, not just those who are most vulnerable to it. Today, that's dropped fairly significantly, and it looks like this weekend it's going to drop even more. Saturday, actually, I think it's going to rain, which will probably clear up the atmosphere somewhat.
Yeah, again, a reminder for folks in Pennsylvania, a purple air quality alert in effect for all of Pennsylvania's 67 counties. It means air quality will be very unhealthy and will impact everyone, not just those with sensitivity to the particulates in the air. So a good reminder there. Let's remind folks about what's going on with sales tax in Sullivan County. We've been talking about this for a little bit. Sales tax revenues down to a point where the county legislature looking at, you know, how they can mitigate this, but maybe a little sign of improvement.
Oh, yes. There was some light at the end of the tunnel that was put up. Although, of course, if you talk to our budget people, they're like, don't count on anything yet. We're only halfway through the year. But and as you would expect, actually, the gap has lessened the sales tax deficit because people are buying more, especially this time of year. So our county treasurer, Kathleen Laura, wasn't available yesterday. I'm going to forget what Shannon Armbrust's actual title is, but she works in the county treasurer's office, has been there for many, many years. And I apologize, Shannon, but she was there on her behalf to talk about the sales tax with legislators yesterday, and said that the decrease, or we're under about $1.7 million from this time last year in sales tax revenue, which is a good improvement. But if this trend continues, we would still be over $6.5 million less than we were the year before. And that would require alone, just to make up that gap, a 9% tax increase, just under 9% to offset that. So, of course, our budget folks are still watching, hoping that it continues to improve as it has been. But if it's not, we're still taking those actions. Like I said, I think last week or the week before, all the departments and offices have been told to find places to reduce expenses by 10% and not to increase expenses anywhere else where, unless it's absolutely necessary. We've not been filling a lot of vacant positions. Of course, there are ones that are mandatory and absolutely ones that we have to. So it continues to be a balancing act, and it will continue to be until the budget gets proposed in probably October or November, and then legislators will actually adopt it in December.
And have any services been cut or paused in reaction to this deficit?
No, not that I'm aware of. This is looking ahead to 2027. 2026, everything's already budgeted and being spent there. Obviously, if people find ways and places to save taxpayers' money in county government, I applaud that as much as the next person. So, and I know that's happening in different places, but I don't believe anyone is actually slashing services or depriving people of the programs they need to have at this moment.
When departments are asked to look to next year's budget and cut by 10%, what's the deadline for that in order to start considering all of the budget for in October, as you said? When do you have to kind of have that sent over to be numbers crunched?
Well, the process is already in play right now. In fact, I think some of the departments and offices have already put forward some proposals to the county manager's office and our Division of Management and Budget, which then will spend probably a good amount of time in September and October going over everything that has been put to them, and then maybe making further cuts on things, or saying, no, we can't or we won't cut that. And then putting that together into a tentative or proposed budget that gets pushed to legislators, because they're the ultimate decision makers on this, usually late October, early November. And then legislators have till December 20th. And they can make all sorts of changes as well, and they may very well, depending on what they want to do. For example, they could say, we're not going to increase taxes. We'll just dip deeper into our fund balance, which is our reserve funds. Or we're going to keep this service, but get rid of that service. It's, again, what Josh puts to them, the county manager, Josh Potosik, is proposed. It's tentative. It's what he recommends and the budget staff recommend based on all the factors they know. But there are other factors that legislators will take into consideration. And, of course, public comment as well. We want the public to be involved in this.
So a few glimmers of hope there in the sales tax revenues improving, but no one getting too excited.
No. We're maybe the corners of our lips here have turned up a little bit, like, oh, okay, this is a little better than we thought.
A grin.
But it's not a full-blown smile, because there are still difficult decisions to be made. And look, I say this again and again. I know sometimes people don't believe me when I say it, but I'm there personally. I see it. There are so many people very, very cognizant, extremely sensitive to the plight of taxpayers in Sullivan County. Nobody wants to do any kind of significant tax increase just so their pet project can continue to go. Most of those folks are actually local property taxpayers as well, so they're going to feel the pain with everybody else. So there is a lot of work being done and will continue to be done to avoid any kind of painful tax increase.
There will be some increase, but you're saying you're trying to avoid something major.
There is every effort to try to get us to that 2% property tax cap that I think I talked about a week or two ago. And at least with these numbers we're seeing with sales tax, that actually may be more of a reality than we had thought before.
Shannon Armbrust is the Senior Fiscal Administrative Officer.
I knew you were looking that up, and thank you, Tim, and sorry, Shannon, but it's one of those long titles that's hard for me to remember.
She's worked there for 15 years to manage county financials.
I know. I'm going to hear it when I get back, reporting. I'm sure. So she's great at what she does.
Try SFAO. That'll help.
Okay. Yeah,
call
sure.
Call her the SFAO. Thanks.
Is this mnemonics class? Is that what it is?
We're talking to Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government. Let's talk a little bit about what else the legislature talked about yesterday in their session. Hiring an investigator to enforce the solid waste flow control law. First of all, what's the solid waste flow control law and why do you need a detective?
I'd love to hear you say that three times fast. Solid waste flow control law.
You say senior fiscal operating officer.
Yeah. All right. Touche. The flow control law has been in place in the county for many, many years, and it mandates that any garbage produced in Sullivan County needs to be disposed of in Sullivan County. And part of that is just good policy, but part of that also is it's fiscally smart to do that because we run a solid waste system. We don't have to, by the way, but we do, and that needs to be as much as possible self-sustaining. So the fees and things that are generated from tossing that garbage here. However, we have found in the past, and this really applies to haulers, we don't really know about individuals. I'm sure it does happen with individuals too, but that when fees are cheaper in neighboring municipalities or states even, that people will transport their garbage there. And technically that is illegal according to county law. So don't do it, Tim. So now the legislature and part of this is motivated by the fiscal situation. They're saying, let's get a little more focused on this and actually try to enforce this law with haulers. This is not, again, I've said to people, we are not going to have people sitting at the borders of Sullivan County checking everyone's vehicle for garbage. That is not the kind of police state you or I want to live in, nor legislators. What this will be is an investigator who is hired and will actually go and randomly follow different garbage trucks and see where they're going. And if they are picking up garbage in Sullivan County but disposing it of elsewhere, they will be written up. They will be cited.
So these are some of the major haulers in the county. Is this how big of an issue is this? Enough to hire an investigator?
I think the investigator is going to help us figure out how big an issue of it is. I mean, anecdotally, I've been told it is in the hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of dollars that we're losing because people are going to other counties. But I've also just heard, I think, from our Public Works Commissioner Ed McAndrew yesterday that currently we're real competitive with our fees right now. So he doesn't think it's at the moment so much of an issue, but it could be again.
Why are fees a little higher in Sullivan County versus surrounding counties where people might be taking this garbage?
Counties can set their own fees. We base it upon what we think, with actual professional haulers, we base it on what the cost is for us to handle and process that waste. But it also is something where for taxpayers, like your per bag fee and everything, I don't think that really covers the costs of operating the solid waste system in its entirety. So the fees are meant to sort of balance that out, but we have to focus on what it costs us versus what it is being charged in, say, Orange County or Ulster County or Delaware County. And so that can create an imbalance. Sometimes it's in our favor. Sometimes it's not in our favor. So,
all right. A request for proposal released for airport operator services. Is this more like inside concessions or is this like for landing? What does it mean when you say airport? Operator services.
Right. So it's the actual technical phrase for it is, let me get it correct here, is airside operator services, which means that you really are helping, as opposed to landside. You're helping the people, the pilots, the planes. You're providing all sorts of services in a manner consistent with FAA regulations. So it means, and this is in the request for proposals, employ an airport staff composed of qualified people who perform their duties at the airport, providing necessary daily operational coverage. So you're going to be helping with, for example, you're going to be taking care of when planes need fueling or when pilots need services for something or they need access, for example, to our pilot's lounge where they can spend the night. Right now we have public works staff doing that.
Right.
And we want to get an actual operator
who's doing that. So an operator for the whole airport, mm-hmm. I see.
Yep. Okay. But also we're looking, if this is an optional part of it, for fixed base operator services, an FBO as it's called, where it would be that you actually have mechanics on duty. We can do repairs there rather than sending you off to another airport. And we would enter into an agreement with this vendor for it where we would get a certain cut of the fees that they charge as well. So this is all moving towards making the airport self-sustaining, taking it off the backs of taxpayers. Currently, I think it's around $550,000 to $600,000 a year that it costs taxpayers. And we're of the firm belief that it doesn't need to. We just need to find the right people to operate the airport.
RFP is out now. When are proposals due?
Proposals are due. They just extended this, actually. So let me get the right date here. Friday, August 21st at 1 p.m. There will be site visits afforded to interested vendors later this month, actually, and they can contact our Office of Purchasing for that, which would be 845-807-0515. That's 807-0515 to get the full RFP and put themselves down maybe for a site visit.
Is the idea to get this off of the 27 budget, so mm-hmm. a quick turnaround?
We're hoping. Yeah, we have people interested. So I'm very optimistic that we're going to get that. I think we need it at the airport because public works, you know, yeah, we mow the grass, we provide fuel services and things, but we don't do that 24/7. We're there usually from about 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. This airside operator could help provide 24/7 services and really make the county airport competitive with some of our downstate airports that we're trying to not steal traffic from, but actually attract some of those folks because they're out of room in like Teterboro and Westchester. And we have room and it's underutilized. We want it to be utilized to the maximum extent.
There is a potentially harmful algae bloom at Lake Superior State Park. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on there and how it's impacting use of the park.
Yeah, it's yucky slime. So
air quality is poor. Slime.
Yeah, who wants to swim or boat in that? So, all kidding aside, it actually could hurt you if you ingested it by accident. I mean, adults maybe not, although I still sometimes suck in some water when I'm swimming and end up sputtering, but kids in particular, too. And it's not something that we can just like move away from the beach. It goes where it's going to go, and some of it's at a microscopic level that you wouldn't necessarily even be able to see. So we do regular testing with the DEC and the DOH at the beach area, and the testing so far has indicated that it's still there. We are doing another test, I believe, today or Monday, and so I know for certain that the beach is not going to be open and boating rentals will not be offered this weekend. The rest of the park, however, is open. And if you bring your own boat or going someplace to go fishing, or you're looking to go picnicking or bring the kids just to enjoy the outdoors on land at Lake Superior, walk around, hike, whatever, that's all open and will continue to be. We're going to hopefully have a turnaround in it's sort of climatic conditions that cause this, and I think that's changing. So usually with some intense heat for a short amount mm-hmm. of time, and right now it's cooling down.
So the beach and boat rentals closed, rest of the park open for this
weekend.
Rest
of the park is open.
A reminder, there's a health and safety extravaganza. This is a good reminder, mm-hmm. considering what we've been talking about. It's next Friday at Public Health and Liberty.
And I promise you, as we said last week, it is an extravaganza. So it runs from noon to 3 p.m. on Friday, the 24th, week from today. We're going to have a vaccination clinic for back-to-school vaccinations that are necessary. But we'll also have a touch-a-truck, a drone demonstration, games and prizes, summer and animal safety education, special needs emergency preparedness, a Lions vision screening. All of this stuff is for free. And if you have have kids who are particularly sensory sensitive, for example, like with autism, things of that nature, from 2 to 3 p.m., we're going to have it be very sensory friendly. So there won't be any loud noises or lots of flashing lights. But if you come before that, 12 to 2, there might be. I think with touch a truck, there's probably going to be maybe some sirens that blow occasionally there.
That's the extravaganza time.
That will be. So it's going to be at our Department of Public Health, which is at 50 Community Lane, part of our social services complex in Liberty. Everyone's invited. Costs nothing.
A free citizen preparedness training class coming up, too. Looking for folks to register for that coming up at the end of the month.
Yes, yes. And that's going to be at our Emergency Operations Center. I don't have it right in front of me. What is the time?
It's July 31st at 10.
Thank you. July 31st at 10. Yes, there we go.
The county training facility.
I have it in front of me now.
It's on White Lake Turnpike.
All right,
that's in Swan Lake.
All right. Embarrassing me on the radio.
Shannon's title?
Senior Fiscal Administrative Officer.
Yes.
There we go. I redeemed myself. So, yes, July 31st, 10 a.m., it's our emergency operations training facility. This is a cool place just go visit anyway. Old White Lake Turnpike in Swan Lake. It's near the airport. It's right off Route 55. It's actually where next week we will be having our summer youth or emergency services youth academy that we have every year. So it's a pretty cool place. You'll be hearing me talk about it more next week.
The Move Sullivan Monticello shuttle stops and times are changing on Monday to remind folks.
Right. Yep. Today's the last day that we will be doing the Monticello shuttle and just the Monticello shuttle. It's a short loop that we do in the way that we do it. We're changing it from, I think it was like 9 stops every hour to 11 stops every 45 minutes. But there's too much to explain here over the radio. Just go to movesullivan.com and you will find information about the new routes there.
Service continuing, just adjusting the number.
And just for that loop, every other route that we have is staying the same as it always does.
Compost news, food scraps now being accepted at Coshecton Transfer Station.
Yeah, this is really cool. I talked about this before that we are really ramping up our composting efforts and now we are able to accept food scraps at every transfer station. Last time I talked about it, we could accept it at every single one except the one probably you use, which is the Western Sullivan Transfer Station in Coshecton off of County Route 114. And, of course, that's open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 7:45 a.m. to 2:45 p.m. We are going to accept fruits, veggies, meat, poultry, fish, shellfish, dairy products, bread, pasta, rice, grains, all that stuff that would smell up your garbage, but not pet waste, not plates or cups or takeout containers or non-recyclable materials. We want pure compost, which we then ship off and actually get turned into compost that will be used in people's gardens. And hopefully in another few years here, when we finally get all the DEC permission that we need, it'll actually be compost we create in Monticello and sell back to county residents.
Do you need to put that in a special bag or container?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. You cannot throw it in with the container. You got to remove stickers, bands, ties, and things like that. You got to just toss the food in.
And the Minisink Battleground event, the encampment and commemoration, is this weekend. 3-day event in Fort Delaware closed because of that.
Yes, because the staff at Fort Delaware, who are employed by the Delaware Company, they operate it for us. They also operate Minisink Battleground Park. That's where they're all going to be, because this is not just our annual commemoration of the Battle of Minisink from 1779. This is a much bigger thing. We're commemorating the Revolutionary War's 250th anniversary overall. We're going to have reenactors doing an encampment there. They're going to spend Friday and Saturday night at the Battleground Park. And so during the days on Friday and Sunday as well, you're welcome to stop by on Saturday and see what these folks are doing, how they live. They'll have demonstrations on how they cooked, how they slept, how they hunted, how they fired muskets. And then at 4 o'clock on Saturday, we will have the actual commemoration ceremony, which I will be recording and putting up on county social media.
And Town of Eldred also hosting a big block party on Sunday as part of the celebrations from noon to 9.
Timed to be right after we end at the Minisink Battleground Park, because it's just a hop, skip, and a horse jump to Eldred. So,
party like it's 1776.
Right.
All right. Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. Thanks for being here. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure.
Still to come, the Delaware Youth Center's annual river race. We'll talk about it with the race director and the community effort behind the event and how every mile helps support local kids. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's all about summertime hosting and guesting in delicious style. From brilliant, simple sides and desserts you can bring to your next party to a lifestyle expert's tips on hosting, that's all coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware Youth Center's biggest fundraiser of the year returns to Calicoon this weekend, bringing hundreds of runners, walkers, and volunteers together along the Delaware River. The 28th annual River Race raises money to support the Youth Center's programs for local children and families while drawing participants from across the region. Joining us now to talk about this year's race and its community impact is Race Director Edward Vanderschans. Ed, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah,
we've got an exciting weekend ahead.
Yeah, we're pulling you away from some of the prep right now. So give us a little overview. What can people expect this year, the 28th year?
Yeah, like you said, 28th year. This is my second year as race director. So hopefully I'm stepping up on my efforts from last year. we've got about 500 people expected to join us, which is a very similar number to last year. The race is a 5K and 10K, and it's along River Road here in beautiful Calicoon. We would expect the race to start at 8:15 a.m., so it should be nice and cool. The air quality is better than it has been for the last few days, so if you're willing and able, we'd love to see you down here in Calicoon.
It's become a tradition in the area in Calicoon. What keeps people coming back year after year?
Well, I think the fact that the youth centre has been here so long and it's such a focal point of the community, I think that's why we've seen so many people joining the race and the number of participants increasing year over year. Just to give you an example, we have over 60 sponsors of the race this year, and most of those are local families and local businesses. A lot of the people that sponsor also run the race. And obviously, it brings a lot of people into Calicoon to spend the day, spend the morning. So it does benefit the local businesses in return. So I think that's why it keeps on growing and growing. And yeah, hopefully this year is our best one yet.
And we are one of those proud sponsors. However, I won't be running. tell us how the money raised supports the Delaware Youth Center and the young local kids.
Yes, certainly. So this is one of our biggest fundraisers of the year. Last year, we raised just over $50,000 for the Youth Centre. And this year, we're very much on track to match that. If we get a late push of participants and raffle ticket buyers, I would hope that we'll be able to surpass it. The Youth Centre has an annual budget in excess of $200,000. So that runs the facilities here that we have. It runs the summer programs. There's swimming camps for the local kids. We have arts and crafts. There's pickleball courts. There's so many things that go on throughout the year, and a lot of those are subsidized, and a lot of those are held in the facilities that we've got. And I'm sure you're well aware, the cost of running facilities like this continues to go up. So the success of this race is really important for the facility and for the local community that use the youth center throughout the year.
As race director, what's impressed you most about the community support behind this event?
I would say that it's the width and breadth of the supporters that we get. Like you said, Radio Catskills has been a supporter for many years. Local Wayne Bank has been our timing sponsor now for a couple of years. And we've got even local coffee shops, restaurants. They all chip in ways that they can. And even a small contribution contributes to a really big impact. So for me, it's how many people do what they can, realise the importance of the youth centre, and year after year continue to support us and the race.
There are several ways to participate. There's a 5K, 10K, a walk, a virtual race, and you also have same-day registration if somebody's thinking about signing up at the last minute?
Yes, we do. So the easiest way to sign up is currently on the website, which is delawareyouthcentre.org/river-race. That's pretty easy to find on Google. Current pricing is $35 for the 5K walk and run, $40 for the 10K. If you can sign up for the virtual run because you can't make it on the day, we'd love to see your pictures, love to see the effort and training that you do. That's $25, and obviously that money goes to supporting the youth centre. Another way that you can support is by the raffle that we have. Tickets can be purchased online as well, and we've got some wonderful prizes there. Bethel Woods has once again sponsored us for some of the lawn passes. Villa Roma is once again sponsored for some of the golf and facilities that they've got there. So some great prizes, some great opportunities. And like I said, every dollar raised goes to the youth centre in some way.
And the virtual race honors Gary A. Wing-Lovitz. Can you share the story behind that tradition and why it continues to be such an important part of the event?
Yes, certainly. So the virtual run, I believe, is in its maybe eighth or ninth year. Gary used to attend the youth centre when he was a kid and was very much part of the community here. Sadly, he passed away far too soon, and the virtual run was set up basically in his memory. We've had runners that have joined the virtual run from as far afield as Europe, Australia. So if you know anybody that's interested or you can't make it on race day, the virtual race is a really good way to support the youth centre and join in on the fun and the activities that we've got, and support the youth centre in a slightly different way to attending on race day.
Edward Van Der Zandt is the race director of the 28th annual Delaware Youth Centre River Race, taking place on Sunday along the beautiful Delaware River in Calicoon. Edward, have a great race. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, and good luck to all the runners and participants this weekend. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about music for the music to the people, an evening celebrating the enduring power of protest songs, from historic anthems to messages that continue to resonate today. This is Radio Chatskill.
Before the U.S.-Iran war, about one-fifth of the world's oil passed freely through the Strait of Hormuz. Now Iran controls the strait and ship traffic is stalled. What precedent does that set for other waterways?
What now, the U.K. or Morocco claiming control over the Strait of Gibraltar, or Malaysia claiming control over the Balkan Strait?
I'm Elsa Chang. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
On this Old House Radio Hour, we settle the debate, top load or front load, which washing machine reigns supreme.
There is one difference that front loaders can take advantage that top loaders cannot, and it's gravity.
Plus, author Mary H.K. Choi on the suburban Texas house that left a homesick teenager wondering if she'd landed in a horror movie. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, when a beloved tree was mysteriously cut down in a national park in Britain, people across the country called it slaughter.
They said things like, "R.I.P. beautiful tree, I wish I'd got to meet you."
But the suspect could not care less. My understanding, he said, was that it was just a tree. The very serious and entirely ridiculous criminal trial over a murdered tree this week.
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Music has long been a soundtrack for social movements, from the civil rights movement to anti-war demonstrations and labor organizing. And this weekend, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance is bringing that tradition to the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg with Music to the People, an evening of protest songs featuring local and regional performers sharing songs of hope, resistance, and social justice. Joining us now are Kat Montese from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and our own Radio Catskills, Kathy Geary, a performer at the event and host of Now and Then, Saturdays at 3. Good morning to you both.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Kat, tell us about Music to the People. What inspired DVAA to present an evening centered on protest songs?
Well, given where we are, our proximity to Bethel Woods, the site of the Woodstock Music Festival, and sort of given what's going on in the world right now, it felt really appropriate and like something that people really crave is an experience that is music-centered, art-centered, and that expresses, I think, a lot of the feelings of the moment. And then I was really inspired by Richard Holler specifically. He was part of our Salon series back in the winter at DVAA, and he sang this beautiful original protest song that he had written. And afterwards, I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could have a whole show of music like this? So in a lot of ways, he was the impetus for the show.
Kathy, protest songs tell the stories of ordinary people facing extraordinary challenges. Protest music has been a part of American history for generations. Why do you think these songs continue to resonate today, and what makes this genre meaningful to you?
Well, you know, the song that is the most critical song for social justice in my lifetime was Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind. And, you know, he was only 21 years old in 1962 when he wrote that song. So I've known the lyrics for Blowing in the Wind for over 60 years. And it's interesting because, you know a song, you don't think about it, and then all of a sudden, in the past year or two, that song has taken on new relevance for me. It's a very gentle song, but it's a very powerful song, and it's not an accusatory, aggressive song. It speaks to you as if you're a friend. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. So I think it invites a coming together, and I think the relevancy of it is astounding how it still is relevant today, as it was when he wrote it at such a young man.
It sounds like we lost Kat there. We'll try to get her back. But as you say, that song, decades old, still feels remarkably current. And you mentioned also that it brings people together. And do you think that and other protest songs are able to bring people together even when they disagree? Have you experienced that in your own performances?
Well, you know, I really have. It's interesting. There's so many different topics that you can use for a protest song. And there's some issues that affect people regardless of your political affiliation. How are you recognized? How does society see you? How many roads do you have to walk down? How many different people do you have to be before you're acknowledged as an important person in society? Not only Bob Dylan, another song that I'll be singing in the concert. I'm so excited to perform in this concert. You know, a lot of the protest music comes out of a younger generation. So Bob Dylan was 21. Joni Mitchell was 27 in 1970 when the very first Earth Day began. In 1970, the beginning of the environmental music, the environmental protest songs, she wrote a humorous song called Big Yellow Taxi. They paved paradise. They put up a parking lot. You don't know what you've got till it's gone. And there's a certain humor in there, but there's a certain depth of meaning. And that song is as relevant today. And those kinds of things, the things, the world that we live in, it doesn't matter your political affiliation. You need to have clean air. You need to have clean water. And you need to have good food. Mm-hmm. So those ideas are relevant regardless of if you're on the left or on the right. And those songs have lasted for decades in our culture. Everybody knows these songs.
I think
it pulls people together.
Yeah. I think we have Kat back. Yeah. Kat, are you there?
Kat, welcome back.
Hi. Thank you.
Now, is the event intended to be a political event, a historical exploration, or more of a celebration of music's ability to bring people together, Kat?
Yes, and. I think it's, I think for me, you know, the healing power of music is something I sort of never get over. When people have an event, especially like an art-centered event, an event centered around music, I wanted to create something where people feel less alone, and also that they feel like their arts organizations are checked in with how they're feeling in this particular moment in time. I mean, we can't really separate art from culture, from history, from the now. So I'm hoping that this event will be something that is therapeutic, that is community-centered, and also that is historical. Like, I know that, you know, we'll be hearing original songs, but also we might be hearing covers of songs, like Kathy mentioned, you know, Bob Dylan's Blown in the Wind, songs that people have been singing for a long time and that resonate, you know, ever more today.
And Kathy, you know, we mentioned what's going on in the world politically, in the country politically. It's also America's 250th anniversary year. Does that milestone add another layer of meaning to revisiting these songs?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, I hadn't considered that. I believe that it does. There's, you know, a whole new focus on what is America? Who are we in the United States? 250 years is not a very long time in comparison to some of the civilizations and the cultures, you know, in history. So we're still a very young country. And I still think in a lot of ways the idea of American individualism, you know, the idea that you can fulfill your life and have a dream, you know, that is something people are still pursuing and trying to understand how to make that possible. And music, I loved what you said, Kat. You really can't separate art from culture. And for me, I was so excited to be invited. And when I was invited, I can bring to this concert my own choice of music. I am not familiar, unfortunately, with the singing resistance choir that Tanis Kowalczyk does. But I did contact Elizabeth Rose because I was very curious, what kind of songs, what music will you be performing? So it's going to be a very exciting concert. It's going to be a very exciting concert.
Kathy,
one of the things, I'm very excited to introduce a young protest singer to the audience that they probably will not know. I'll be singing a song by Jesse Wells. And our younger generation is, they're very concerned about artificial intelligence. And Jesse Wells has a song. The songs I'm singing are gentle. They're not aggressive. The song I'm singing by him is called "Will the Computer Love the Sunset?" And I'm excited to be able to share that with people.
Kathy, you mentioned some of the other performers. I just want to make sure we mention them. Elizabeth Rose, Richard Hohler, Open for Suggestions, the Singing Resistance NEPA Choir, and yourself. What do you hope folks take home, not just musically, but personally, after spending this time with you and engaging in this music to the people?
Well, you know, Kat said it. I hope that it gives them a sense of belonging to a community, that they're not alone in their feelings, that it validates the sense that we need to come together and that there's a power and a healing in coming together. And I hope that that experience resonates as they listen to all the different performers. I'm excited to hear the Singing Resistance Choir. I'm excited to hear Richard Hohler and his original music. And I hope the audience has a sense of belonging to a community and being a part of a greater understanding. And music can do that.
Kat, let's remind
folks. I'm also excited to see the Revolutions exhibition the DVA has.
That's part of it,
a companion piece for that. And I have not seen that exhibition. I know it's running through July 26th, but I'm very curious, you know, how that might integrate in relationship to their exhibition, Revolutions.
Kat, let's remind folks of the details about Music to the People, an evening of protest songs, and the exhibition. How can folks attend and get more info?
They can go to Delaware Valley Arts Alliance.org. They can get tickets online. They're also welcome to come and get tickets right at the theater at will call. We'll be there to welcome them. And we are just really, really excited to bring this to the people and to bring this collection of really special, talented musicians to share their gifts and hopefully inspire everyone who's there to listen.
That's Kat Montese of Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and musician and host of Now and Then here on Radio Catskill, Kathy Geary, who's performing at Music to the People, an evening of protest songs tomorrow at the Tustin Theater. And it is co-presented by Radio Catskill. Thank you both and have a great show.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks, Kat.
Coming up, if you've ever found an old family photo with no names, no dates, and no clues, we're going to be talking to a photo detective next to explain how clothing and hairstyles and even the photo itself can help identify the people and stories behind the picture. That's next. This is Radio Catskill.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Rahm Emanuel hasn't announced that he's running for president, but he's not running either.
You're going to have 31 flavors. It's going to be Baskin and Robbins. As I said, if I decide to do this, I'm going to be Rocky Road. That's the flavor I'm going to go with, brother.
Rahm Emanuel on what the Democrats need to do to win. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. If you've ever discovered a box of old family photographs and wondered who's pictured or what stories those images might hold, this weekend's program at the Gilboa Museum could help unlock some of those mysteries. The museum is hosting nationally recognized genealogist, author, and public speaker Maureen Taylor, also known as the Photo Detective, on Saturday at 1. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to her about reading the clues hidden in old photographs.
The Gilboa Museum in Gilboa, New York, is having an event coming up this Saturday, the 18th at 1 o'clock. And this is quite an interesting one. They are going to have a talk given by Maureen Taylor, who is a photography detective. So Maureen is here to tell us what that is and how she trained to be a detective. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Valerie. How are you?
I'm good.
So I started my career as a curator of photographs and postcards and architectural drawings and everything sort of non-print or non-manuscript. And I help people with their family photographs. So say your mother, grandmother, aunt, uncle, someone gave you some family photographs and you don't know much about them. I'm the person that can help you put that information together, attach that information in the context of your family history, show you how to share it with other family members, and organize and preserve it as well. So everything from identification through how to take care of your pictures.
And what are the tools you use to do that?
Well, I have been a photo detective for quite a while, so I can look at your photograph and tell you a lot about it right from just looking at it. But for organization and preservation, there are lots of tools. There's, you know, Gaylord Company for proper supplies to maintain your pictures so they'll last for the next generation or two. There are websites like forever.com for digital organization. Of course, researching the people in the photographs once you have a date and a possible identity. It's all the genealogy websites. The most famous, of course, is ancestry.com.
So that's a kind of a big project.
It can be a big project if you have a lot of photographs, but I also lead you through the process, if you work with me one-on-one, to develop a plan so that it doesn't become overwhelming. Do this first. What photograph speaks to you the most? Is that the photograph we want to start with? How many photographs do you have? What do you want to do with them? Is there someone in your family that's going to take them over after you? None of us are going to live forever, unfortunately.
What exactly will you be doing during your talk?
So I'm going to talk in Gilboa about genealogical clues in family photographs and local history photographs, community photographs. And we have some examples from Gilboa that I'll be talking about. I'll be covering sort of the basics of how you identify a photograph and, you know, research the clues to, you know, how does AI change what we do, and colorization, plus, minus, is it good, is it not? We're going to cover a lot of stuff in this talk.
And this is being done with a couple of the local historical societies, I see, Stamford as well as Jefferson Historical Society. So it's quite a collaborative endeavor.
Yes, and we've gotten great publicity for this event, so I'm optimistic. It's absolutely free to attend. It's 1 o'clock at the Gilboa Museum. And I'll give my talk and then meet people. We'll have some books for sale. And we're just going to have a great time. You never have a bad time when you talk about photographs. Everybody's got photographs.
Well, I recently interviewed a person that restores books. That was also so interesting in how that research goes and the tools used and the number of people that showed up with old family books.
I'm sure. And there'll likely be some people that bring a photograph or two with them as well.
Can you give us your website?
Sure. My website, if anyone wants to contact me for whatever reason, my website is maureentaylor.com, and that's maureentaylor.com. I have a blog. I am also on social media, meaning Facebook, LinkedIn, Substack, Instagram as the photo detective. So I'm reachable through all of those avenues as well.
Do you give any online courses?
I do. I have online courses on preserving your family photographs. Essential photo organizing is a popular course. I have ebooks on the website. I offer my own presentations from time to time. And so, yes, I mean, we pretty much live in a virtual world these days. So I'm really excited to be in person in Gilboa.
Yes, that's a treat.
It is a treat.
Do you live near there?
No, I actually live in Rhode Island.
Oh, okay. So you're making the trip.
We're making the trip to the Catskills.
Oh, well, enjoy. It's a beautiful spot, as well as Rhode Island is a beautiful spot. One other thing that I'd like to add about the Gilboa Museum is that it has a collection of Devonian period fossils. That's an interesting thing for our listeners to know about. And if they go to Gilboa Museum, you'll find a lot of information about the museum and all of the different events up there that are quite wide-ranging.
Yes, they're going to give me a tour. I can't wait. Now, if only, Valerie, I could find the fossil that I have here in the house.
Yes.
I packed it away. And I'm not sure what I've done with it over the years.
Well, it'll show up.
It will show up. I didn't get rid of it, that's for sure.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time to share this information with our listeners.
And I look forward to meeting people on Saturday.
Yeah, and have fun at your event.
Thank you.
There's more information at Gilboa Museum's website. It's gilboafossils.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
This week on Science Friday, step away from that bag of lettuce.
At the CDC, doctors and public health officials have tried to get a handle on a miserable parasite that leads to a lot of time on the toilet.
We're checking in on the Cyclospora outbreak, plus the latest on alpha-gal syndrome, a tick-borne red meat allergy. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Amy Brightfield. Thank you so much for your support during our summer fun drive. Your gift will help Radio Catskill keep going and keep growing for everyone. Thank you so much for your continued support.
It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There's an air quality alert in effect in New York and in all of Pennsylvania as well. Air quality levels continue to be greater. Fine particulates are affecting health concerns for folks who may have sensitivity to elevated levels of pollutants, including the very young and those with pre-existing respiratory problems such as asthma and heart disease. Please do take precaution and try to stay inside if possible. A little cooler today, high of 80 with hazy sunshine. A brief shower or two might pop up later tonight with a low of 58. There could be more smoke on the way tomorrow and also a thunderstorm or shower expected. Humid, high 75. Sunny and less humid on Sunday with a high 75. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.